All right, John the 8th chapter, and last week we, as you remember, looked at the section here dealing with Jesus and the woman that they, that the Jewish leaders brought before him, that was caught in the very act of adultery, so they said, and we, of course, realize, as we talked about last week, we know from verse 6 that they were basically testing him, trying to entrap him. And I made mention of the fact that really even before verse 6, we know that something is going on here because they bring the woman and not the man. And so we know that they're not interested in justice here. We don't even know if the man is in custody or anything. But that's just sort of how they treated women back in those days, of course, in that part of the world. And, but the man's nowhere to be found. And so it's not a matter of justice. They're just trying to entrap Jesus. As we said last week, even the whole question of what they should do with her. Remember, they held out the law of Moses and said that Moses in the law commanded that a woman such as this be stoned. Yet they knew that it had been years since they had practiced capital punishment because they didn't have the authority to do so. John chapter 18, verse 31. That emphasizes that they were under Roman rule, so they just didn't have the authority to do that, and they hadn't done that for a long time now. And so they're just, this whole scene is one that is meant to entrap Jesus. And they demonstrate their true nature, these Jewish leaders, their lack of compassion, their hypocrisy, all of that just by the way that they're treating this woman. It was wholly unnecessary for them to bring this woman out before the entire crowd and put her in the midst of them and to make an open spectacle of her like that was uncalled for. But again, Jesus knew what they were trying to do. And so in his response to them in verse 7, you remember, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. And we made, we emphasized last week, if you weren't here, that Jesus, one of the things, Jesus knew the law. And here they think, remember that they have Jesus, no matter how he answered this question of what he should do, what they should do, or what should be done with this woman. If he says, oh, just have compassion on her, and then and she shouldn't be stoned, and they would accuse him of not keeping the law. Of disrespecting the law of Moses, that of course would drive a wedge between him and the people. If he said, well, we ought to go ahead and stone her, that's what the law of Moses said, then they could actually present him before the Romans as an insurrectionist and one who was breaking Roman law. And so they really think they have him in a trap and he can't get out. And it was a masterful way that he responded. Ultimately, he ignored them at first, but ultimately set forth those words there at verse 7. Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. So that just threw this whole thing completely upside down. Now, just like that, the pressure is not on him at all and what he would do and what he would say, but now it's on them. And he recognized several things. There's one of the things that commentaries like to, or they debate over, really, is when he says that the one who is without sin, some believe that he means by that the particular sin of adultery. And several commentaries who are Greek scholars suggest that that is implied by the Greek text there. And that'd be nice if that were the case. I couldn't really verify that in any of the references that I have. And so I'm not quite sure that that's the case. It may have been. Maybe he was asking them. He definitely knew the hearts of the people, of the accusers there. And maybe he was simply saying nothing more than if let the one who is not either guilty of adultery or at the very least had a desire, adulterous desires, throw the first stone. And some believe that. It may, though, have been just more in general. And the one who hasn't, if you haven't sinned, then you go ahead and throw the first stone. One thing I am sure of, though, is that Jesus knew the law. Deuteronomy chapter 17 at verse 6, as we pointed out last week, the law demanded that the eyewitness be the one that throw the first stone. So this whole situation was basically, if not a violation of the law of Moses, they were at least trying to circumvent the law by having Jesus even answer this question. If they were even thinking about stoning that woman on the spot here, then they would be violating the law themselves. And perhaps one, as we suggested, maybe Jesus knew, being the Son of God, maybe one of them were actually eyewitnesses to this particular crime. More likely, though, the eyewitness, whoever caught this woman and the man who is now gone in this particular act, is probably not there, which would mean that they're just ignoring that portion of the law. They would be guilty again then of at least suggesting that the law be broken. But whatever the case is, as he talks about throwing the first stone, the one who is without sin, they would all immediately know. They knew that they were acting in a hypocritical way, a lack of compassion. Everything about what they were doing, this would be kind of, you know, what they call a kangaroo kind of court here. Just they've thrown this whole thing together. It's unjust and all. And again, they're willing to circumvent the law just to entrap Jesus. So when he surprisingly brings up their own moral situation, they would immediately begin to feel some guilt about the whole thing. And as it turns out, as they contemplate this situation, all right, which one of us is without sin? And knowing how unjust they were in their own hearts, they begin to walk away one at a time, the eldest to the youngest. And so he did more than answer them. He really shifted the whole thing onto them. And their own bringing out, revealing their own violation of the law, or at least an attempt to do so. Well, down at verse 10 then, it says, Jesus stood up and he said to her, this is after, of course, they now have all gone away, all the accusers. Woman, where are they? He says, has no one condemned you? And she said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. Go from now on and sin no more. And two things in verse 10 and 11. First of all, Jesus, obviously, what was the purpose of Jesus coming to this earth? To save sinners. That's exactly right. Jesus, in answering and making these statements to this woman, we know he recognized his mission here on earth. It was not to condemn sinners. And so when he says to this woman, I will not condemn you, that wasn't in any way him not meeting his responsibility as the Messiah or anything like that. He was actually doing exactly what he came to do, to save, to forgive, not to condemn. Remember in John chapter 3, way back in John chapter 3, after the great verse 16, we're all familiar with verse 16, of course. God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son. But look at verse 17. In verse 17 it says, for God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. And so Jesus wasn't in the business of condemning. Him saying to this woman, neither do I condemn you, is in line and in harmony with his very purpose of coming to this world, not to condemn, but to save. Now, that doesn't mean that Jesus isn't going to condemn ultimately. He is going to judge. We all know what the Bible says about that, in that we are all going to stand before the judgment seat of who? Of Christ. So he's going to judge. And there's no question about that. But it's not time for that yet. And certainly, obviously, wasn't when he was here on earth. And even now, he's still in the role that God the Father has placed him in to save, not condemn. Later on, he'll be in the judging business and judge the whole world. But he came to save. And he knew that just a little while from this particular situation that he would die on the cross. And his blood, of course, would save all of those who would obey the gospel of Christ and even the Old Testament saints who were faithful. And he was hoping this woman, too, that she would live in such a way that she could be saved. So after he says to her, I won't condemn you either, what does he tell her? Which tells us the second thing. Jesus knew his mission. He wasn't here to condemn. It wasn't his place right there in that situation to condemn this woman. But neither did he ignore sin. And he never did that or encouraged sin in any form or fashion. His message to her is the same message he has through his word to us. Sin no more. And we see Jesus on different occasions throughout the Gospels of him healing someone and then encouraging them to straighten their lives out. And so that, again, is keeping with the saving aspect of the Savior. That's what he came to do, not to condemn, but to save. And so some people have looked at this overall story here and concluded, particularly because Jesus made the statement, those of you who are without sin or him who is without sin, throw the first stone, that somehow or another he has set that as a criterion for attacking sin or speaking out against sin. The only way you can do that, some people say, is if you have never sinned. And, I mean, that is obviously ridiculous, taking that statement out of its context. And Jesus isn't indicating that at all. We have to fight against sin. We have to speak out against sin. And raise your hand if you're without sin. Anybody here? We're all sinners, aren't we? And fall short of the glory of God. That's not the criterion that God has set up. This is a unique situation. Jesus knew who he was talking to. He knew the hearts of these individuals who were hypocrites, who were doing all of this just to entrap Jesus. And besides all of that, you just think about the overall situation. They bring this woman before him. She has sinned. It wasn't his responsibility, once again, to do anything with this woman. If she is guilty of violating the law, she should be punished. But who should do the punishing? Was it the responsibility of Jesus to pick up a stone and throw it at her? No. Nor was it right and in keeping with the law for them, if he would have said, have at it, for them to pick up stones and stone her at that particular time. That wouldn't be the right way to do it. People who break the law need to pay the penalty for the law, but you have to go through the right procedures, don't you? And certainly that is always the case. And they were, again, advocating even bypassing all of that here. So that would have been wrong with itself. But there's nothing in this passage to indicate, well, the only way we can speak out is if we are without. In fact, that would make preaching the gospel of Christ impossible. Every time you preach the gospel, you're making a judgment that somebody needs the gospel. If people need the gospel, what situation are they in? They're in sin, aren't they? So if you have to be without sin before you can attack sin or even preach to those who are in sin, trying to help them, that would make even preaching the gospel impossible. That would leave the world in chaos, in confusion, if only the one without sin could do that. So that, I don't know of any biblical scholars who approach this text like that. It's more Bible critics who want to do that. And it just doesn't hold any weight to it, really, any water to it. So that's not what he's saying at all. All right, let's jump down to verse 12 then. Any questions about that story at all? All right, let's go to verse 12. And as we read verse 12, if you weren't here last week, you know that I suggested that it's really a foregone conclusion in the minds of scholars that this particular story doesn't belong exactly in this particular place originally. But I tried to emphasize that doesn't mean it's not inspired, and it doesn't mean it's not historical. The same scholars, the same people who do that for business, who are textual critics and that sort of thing, all almost unanimously affirm that this belongs in the Gospels. They're just not agreed at exactly where. And as you begin, we pick up at verse 12, that sort of verifies that position, because really, when you connect verse 12 with the end of chapter 7, there's a lot better flow to it. And if you look at it critically, you can kind of tell that this story was kind of inserted at a later time. Going back to chapter 7, Jesus, that would go back to what Jesus said in verse 37 of chapter 7, when it says, that's when on the last day of the feast of the great day, Jesus stood up and he cried out, "If anyone thirst, let him come to me and drink." And we, of course, studied all of that. Verse 38, "Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." And you remember when we were looking at that, those words, of course, that got to convincing some among them that he was the Christ. And some said he's the prophet, and the others said he's the Christ. And then some said, no, he's not the Christ at all, because he's from Galilee. And so that caused a great schism there. And there was a great divide. And you can just picture that in your mind as they begin to right there, they begin to debate with each other and argue back and forth about whether he's the Christ or whether he's not the Christ. And again, it specifically says there's a great schism. And right about that time, some of the temple police, they go back to the Sanhedrin down at verse 44. It says in verse 45, the officers then came to the chief priest and the Pharisees who said to them, "Why didn't you bring him?" And so now all of that, verses 45 through 52, is parenthetical. In other words, just picture in your mind, they're here and Jesus says what he does about the living water. And they begin to, some of them believe, and they then begin to argue about it. And in the midst of that, these temple police sneak back to the Sanhedrin, which we'll find out later. The Sanhedrin, they're not but just a little distance away from them in the first place. The hall where the Sanhedrin met is, many believe, close enough to even hear some of the things that the crowd is saying. So, but they go back to the Sanhedrin and report this thing. And so all of that conversation from verse 45 to the end takes place. In the meantime, the crowd's still out there and they're in chaos debating about the Messiah and whether Jesus is the Messiah. So the last thing Jesus says is about the living water. Then, as they're in this midst of this chaotic kind of conversation and debate about Jesus, then in chapter 8 and at verse 12, Jesus stands up again. And notice it says, again, Jesus spoke to them saying, "I am the light of the world." And so that connects with just a little space between him saying that and him talking about being the living water. And both of those things, the language that he uses, both point back to the Feast of the Tabernacles. Remember when we talked about him saying, talking about the living water, what we said, what was going on there? How that during that last day, the great day of the Feast of the Tabernacles, the priest would go off to the pool of Siloam and fill up the golden bowl and bring it back and pour it on the altar. And they would be singing songs, some of the psalms at that time and all of that. All of that was in memory of the time when God gave them water in the wilderness. But that's what they would do during that. And Jesus stands up in the midst of that and talks about the rivers of living water. Well, there was another thing that was going on at that time with the Feast of Tabernacles. And that was the lighting of two great candlesticks, lamps, that they would do every night of the feast. And it was two great lights that they would do. And they would do it every night. And that was to remind the Israelites of the pillar of fire in the wilderness that would give them light in the, you know, at night as they traveled. And so that's why they did that. But they did that most scholars believe, every night of the feast. Well, and so that would be going on too. So Jesus first, because of what they're doing with the water, he stands up and talks about the living water. And then they get into this argument about who he is, some believing and some doubting. Then he stands right back up. And you'd have at least the knowledge of those lights being lit. And Jesus stands up and says, I'm the light of the world. And so it would really put their mind into the right perspective. And of course, Jesus did that a lot in his teaching. He would use things all the time that were right around him and then begin to teach on it. But there's something even that is more specific with that. Again, we don't know for sure that was on Jesus' mind, but that would have all been present. Jesus didn't say, well, I'm the light of the world, and this is why I'm telling you this. It's because, scholars in some ways speculate that would be the thing that motivated Jesus to bring that up at that time. But something that's not speculation is the fact that the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, was always amongst the Jews associated with light. And so that over and over we have. Look over at Isaiah chapter 42. In Isaiah chapter 42, this chapter is, and the surrounding chapters even, is dealing with God's chosen servant. And throughout Isaiah, the chosen servant of God is the Messiah, the Christ that would come. And here in Isaiah chapter 42 at verse 6, says, I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind. Now that's all that is said with regard to God's servant who would be the Messiah. So this is a messianic passage. And describes him as what? As a light for the nations. Over in chapter 49, in Isaiah chapter 49, and at verse 6, once again, he says, it is to light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. And you just get out of concordance. We don't have time to look at all the light passages here, all the prophecies about that. But what I'm saying to you, throughout the Old Testament, there are various passages amongst the prophets that speak of the coming Messiah as light. And that was firm in the minds of the Jews. And now here the Jews, now you get, you just, again, kind of picture this in your mind. They're having a debate, a lively discussion, which the record calls a schism. That they're really debating this thing. There's a divide amongst them, but it's all over the same thing. It's all over whether Jesus is the Messiah. And in the midst of that confusion, in the midst of that division, and them talking about this and arguing whether he's the Messiah, Jesus stands up and says, I'm the light of the world. And they're all thinking about the Messiah already. Some believing he is and some believing he's not, but they're all thinking about the Messiah. And as Jews, they all know that the Messiah is associated with light. And so when Jesus stands up and says, I'm the light of the world, what do you think they would be thinking? That's an affirmation. That's an affirmation that he's the Messiah. And that, of course, we know is exactly who he is. But and so him saying, I'm the light, more than it, him saying that just because that's something that they did during the Feast of Tabernacles and the lighting of the candles, that's probably all true. I wouldn't doubt that at all. Scholars are probably right about that. He did use that kind of thing. But more than anything, that was a symbol associated and really indelibly planted in the minds of the Jews, associated with the Messiah, that he would bring light. And now Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. And Let's go back over then to John at verse 12 and finish that. He says again, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And all of that kind of puts you in mind of the very beginning of this book. There's a reason why John did what he did in John chapter 1. Remember all of that as he talks about that John the Baptist came to bear witness of what? Of the light. And he emphasized, he's not the light, but he's come to bear witness of the true light. And all of that, I can't remember how many times he used the word light in chapter 1, but 6 or 7 times, all in reference to Christ, who is the Messiah. And where did John get that idea? To use that symbol to represent and describe the Messiah. Jesus himself calls himself the light. He is, in a very real sense, the light of the world. What does light do? Yeah, Paul.
You know, when you're talking about him being light, the opposite of Satan is the prince of darkness.
Yes.
So there can't be a bigger contrast than that.
Yes, exactly right.
The darkness is the absence of light.
Yes, which in this very statement, Jesus makes the point that whoever will follow me will not do what? Will not walk in darkness. But what does light do? Huh? It does a couple of things, doesn't it? It exposes. And what has Jesus done with regard to these scribes and Pharisees? He has exposed their hypocrisy, their wickedness, their lack of compassion, all of that. He has constantly, continually exposed. What else does light do? Yes. Very good. And Jesus is the light of life. He's the light of the world. He provides it so that we know exactly where we're going. It is true. If you follow Jesus, you won't walk in darkness. You'll know exactly where you're going in life. And we all should know that. He can help us out of the most difficult situations. Some of the pitiful situations that people find themselves in. If you're addicted to drugs, who can help you get out of that situation? Who can give you the light so you can stop walking in that darkness? Jesus, he's the light of the world. He, through his word, can tell you exactly how to do that. You want to know how to have a good marriage? Who can give you light? Jesus can tell you exactly how to do that. And you know, we can go on and on with that. In every aspect of life, if we follow Jesus, we'll not walk in darkness. If we'll follow Jesus, we'll know exactly how to live, what kind of husband and wives to be, what kind of employees to be, what kind of citizens to be. If we're following Jesus, we'll walk in the light. And that, again, was a favorite thing of John. In 1 John chapter 1, it was all about the light, wasn't it? What does he say? Do you remember in 1 John 1, if you walk in darkness, what does he say about you? You have no fellowship with who? With the Father, with God. That's right. You can't walk in darkness. There's a lot of people who think they can walk in darkness and still be in fellowship with God. And a lot of religious people even think that. But that's what John is saying. No, you can't do that. That the only way, if you walk in the light as he is in the light, you have fellowship one with another. But you have to walk in the light. And how do you walk in the light? By following Jesus. If you follow Jesus, you won't walk in darkness. He is the light. You have to follow him. And that will give you direction. There is no better life, really. When you stop and think about it, there is no better life than a life following Jesus. Doesn't mean that it's free from difficulties. The ups and downs and trials and tribulations, that happens to everybody. But we always have direction. We always know where we're going and where we're heading. If we're following Jesus, helps us to overcome the difficulties and tragedies of life, because we know at the end of the day, we know where we're heading. And that is, of course, to heaven. So Jesus is the light. Now, how do you think these Pharisees took all of this? At verse 13, it says, so the Pharisees said to him, you are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. Now, by this time, these Pharisees, they're not going to agree with anything Jesus says. They are completely hostile at this point. And so now they're accusing him. Well, you know, yeah, all of that, that sounds good. You're the light, you're the light. But you're just bearing testimony about yourself. And perhaps they're thinking, you remember back in chapter 5 and at verse 31. Chapter 5 at verse 31, Jesus said, if I alone bear witness about myself, my testimony is not true. That sounds a lot like their accusation, doesn't it? So it could be that they remembered him saying that. And so now they're kind of attacking him. Well, you're just bearing witness about yourself, so your testimony is not true. And the idea is, even you said that. Except here, now this in the ESV, it says, if I alone bear witness about myself. And even if, I know in some of your translations, alone's not there. The ESV put alone there. I don't think that's in the original text. The ESV doesn't always indicate that. But they put alone because that's basically what he is saying in the context of John chapter 5. And he goes on in John chapter 5 to prove that he wasn't bearing testimony alone. That the Father was bearing testimony with him in many different ways. God bears testimony of Jesus through the prophets. He did it through John the Baptist. He did it through his miraculous works that Jesus performed. He even did it on one occasion with an audible voice. You remember the Mount of Transfiguration. So there's no question about that. And in the context of John chapter 5, Jesus is clearly saying, I'm not bearing witness alone. But they want to take that and say, oh, well, you know, you said, if you bear witness about yourself, your testimony is not true. And Jesus never really did teach that. The fact of the matter is, Jesus did bear witness about himself. He just didn't bear witness about himself alone. He had someone else to bear witness with him, and that someone else, of course, was the Father. And so he's going to talk about that a little bit as we go forward. But the Pharisees are they're trying to pick at him and get anything he can say. Jesus answered, even if I do bear witness about myself. Now, take notice, he's not saying that he's doing that, but he's saying, even if I did bear witness about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I'm going, but you do not know where I come from or where I'm going. So we keep hearing that kind of language from Jesus. And whenever he talks about that and uses that kind of language, it is again an affirmation of his deity. Where is he from? From heaven. That's where he's from. That's where he originated from. That's where he was in the beginning. That's an affirmation of his deity. And so the fact of the matter is, as we'll get into some next week, there's no question that even the law of Moses speaks of the idea of two or three witnesses, you know, needed and necessary. Well, Jesus is going to show that proves that his testimony is valid because he has the witnesses he needs. He's not bearing witness all by himself. But the point is, even if he was, he came from heaven. He came from above. Again, he's divine, an affirmation of his deity. And when you stop and think about this business of, you know, you verify things by two or three witnesses, that has to do with man. Man needs verification. Man needs his testimony to be proven valid by two or three witnesses. God doesn't need that. And Jesus is God. His testimony is true. Even if it's all by himself because of who he is, he's from above. He's God. So he doesn't need validation or verification. He is the Son of God. But the truth of the matter is, he has it. He has someone to bear witness for him and with him. And it's the greatest witness of all. It's the Father himself. And so he gets into that as we go forward. We have a few seconds left here. He says at verse 15, you judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. So he's going to get back to this testimony in the next couple of verses. This is almost like kind of an aside, but you judge according to the flesh. To judge according to the flesh is to judge an outward kind of judgment. Again, as he's already accused them of that earlier on, of judging according to appearance and that sort of thing. And that's how the Jews were judging. They were judging him as if he was bearing testimony all by himself, but they had a deficiency of knowledge with regard to that. He did have someone to bear witness with him. But they were judging just from an outward standpoint, and their judgment was wrong with regard to that. But he says, I judge no one. Now that's an ellipsis, really. What he is saying there, he's not saying that he never judges anyone. He's saying, I don't judge the way you do. How do they judge? According to the flesh. Just an outward, without having all the facts. Jesus never did that. He never, ever judged according to the flesh. He didn't judge like they did. And so we'll pick up there and get back. He picks up the very next verse, and he's right back to talking about the idea of a testimony. And he's going to show he has the testimony of the Father as we go forward with that. So we'll pick up right there about verse 17 or so on next week. Appreciate your attention.